KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman, host of the Tom Hartman Program. I'm a big fan of KBOO Radio, and I'd like to talk to you for a minute about why I'm asking you to support KBOO today. Did you know that you're listening to one of the longest continuously running independent radio stations in America? That's right, KBOO FM has been supported by its members and listeners like you for 54 years. That's almost as long as I've been around. KBOO's goal for the end of the year is $70,000, but quite frankly, I think they can do better than that. They have made giving easy. You can donate online at kboo.fm/give. If you aren't sitting at a computer right now, you can donate from your phone. Just drop them a text using this number, 44321, and send it to KBOO, KBOO. That's 44321, and send it to KBOO. Join your fellow listeners in saying yes to community-powered radio, and thank you for your support.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Community Advisory Board will meet Thursday, December 22nd from 6 to 8 p.m. The meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. At this time, masks are required for in-person attendees.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programmings of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Governance and Policy Committee meets quarterly on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm. to verify that a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
Greetings. I'm called Professor Soul. Broadcasting from the planet of rhythm and blues, I am a musicologist and political commentator.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of the Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Hi, I'm Ava Gercher, the kid reporter.
Yeah, I'm Book Love, and I do book reviews straight out of Jersey.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things.
Race. Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable addressing the issue of race on a variety of topics. Nia, our faith reporter, is on assignment. Today's topic is Home is Where the Violence Is, Domestic Violence in America. The most dangerous time in a relationship is when a woman wants to leave. Home is where the violence is. Half of women who die by homicide in America are killed by an intimate partner or a family member. This is a pandemic within a pandemic. Home is where the violence is.
It's a huge amount of women who are killed by their intimate partners. I mean, it's really reaching crisis level. It's nearly half, and, you know, as people have told us, is probably much larger than what we have already found. So if what we found is 46%, that's just a huge number of women who are killed each year by their intimate partner.
Home is not a safe place for victims, and now you're forced to stay inside because outside is scary.
The most dangerous time in a relationship is when a woman wants to leave.
I think the question is often asked, when a woman is in a potentially violent situation or has experienced violence, why doesn't she leave? It's very difficult when you are not in control. And we've seen this increase in violence that's happened because of COVID. And when I think of violence, I think of environment, that a lot of women are in dangerous environments. Dangerous even if they do leave, where they live and what they might, you know, have to deal with after they've left. They also, you know, are in a position where there are not a lot of resources, there's not a lot of places for them to go. And so the leaving, I think, becomes difficult. Women would leave if they could leave, but they have no place to go. For Black women, oftentimes this person may be a family member, may be related to them. They don't feel comfortable reporting them to the police because they don't know what's going to happen if they do that.
Police and prosecutors and people who work with domestic violence are now looking at attempted strangulation as a huge warning sign. They say that women whose husbands or boyfriends or intimate partners attempted to strangle them have a much higher instance of being killed by that intimate partner. They're training people across the spectrum to look for the warning signs of strangulation, which you might not think. Oftentimes there are no outward signs, but, you know, women might have a hoarse voice, or they might have bloodshot eyes, or they might be very confused because they've lost oxygen to their brain. So they're really trying to look for those signs right now. And prosecutors in Tarrant County, you know, knowing what they know now, they're trying to intervene earlier in these cases.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race. Our topic, Home is Where the Violence Is. Domestic violence in America. Althea, you're from a different generation, a younger generation. In doing the research for this topic, intimate violence, it was heartbreaking for me to see your generation having to deal with the same kind of violence that baby boomers had to deal with, like your mother and grandmother's generation. Why do you think that is? We talk about intergenerational family and intimate violence.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. And as we've mentioned before on this show, you know, one step forward, two steps back. And what intimate partner violence and domestic violence comes down to is systems of oppression. And when we're specifically talking about like heterosexual relationships, that's the oppression of women. And as much as, you know, in the past, you know, 50, 60 years, women have entered the workplace and been able to make their own money, the gender expectations haven't necessarily kept pace with that. And that includes how men view women. So as much as, you know, you are perhaps more likely these days to be exposed to younger heterosexual men who have a greater awareness of some of these issues, there's also a pretty significant pushback to cultural change like this. And as you were mentioning, why is it that leaving a relationship is most dangerous for a woman? It's because it's an instance of loss of control. And that is something that, especially for, you know, men who are dominant in a patriarchal society, that can be challenging to them. And all of these things are compounded by different systems of oppression in society, and all of those need to be addressed in the conversation. But also, as Professor Johnson was saying, for a woman to successfully leave a relationship, that it requires her own independence, it requires her to have an economic state that is sufficient. And that is something that the way our society is structured right now is not guaranteed. And that the expectations of women are that you work and you raise the children and you are, in whatever ways, you know, maintaining the house, you're subservient to your partner in that particular way. And so those are all kind of like the layers on top of layers that haven't necessarily been entirely liberated with younger generations. And even if, you know, there is less of a stigma around divorce or breaking up with someone that has been your partner for a long time, it's still complex and very difficult for women to take that on.
Thank you, Althea. Let's move to Cecil and then wrap it up with Mary Lee. I'll wrap up that particular question with Mary Lee.
I think it is horrible to think about how many, something like 45% of Black women have experienced rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner in their lifetime.
But this new CDC study found one group of women are more at risk. Reviewing data from more than a dozen states, including Ohio, it found Black women are murdered at twice the rate of white, Hispanic, and Asian women.
We just don't trust systems because systems have never worked in our favor.
So Black domestic violence victims are less likely to seek counseling or call police, increasing the risk they'll be killed by their intimate partner.
It's just not a simple matter of leaving. I have to have a plan in place that will allow me to leave safely without the risk of homicide.
Intimate partnered violence means that those who are closest to women are the ones who threaten and commit violence. And so it is very difficult, I would imagine, to leave, to move out of that relationship. And when you try to do that, you are most at risk of being attacked.
Thank you, Cecil. Mary Lee?
Well, I think a couple of things about this question. It's a statistic or a piece of data that I've known for many, many years. I grew up in, and anything I know, I learned at the feet of the women who started the domestic and sexual violence movement. And I say movement because it was a movement. I'm not sure we're so much a movement now as opposed to a system of care or a service delivery system. That's probably a pessimistic or a cynical response. But I came up out of the domestic and sexual violence movement. And so it is very known to me that one of the most dangerous times in the relationship is when the woman tries to leave or expresses that they want to leave. And, you know, understanding the cycle of violence and that there is a cycle and that there are these dynamics, in addition to everything that my colleagues have said, in essence, at that moment in time, the violence that has been so effective for the abuser to be using against his victim has failed, because the evidence of an autonomy or a self-determination or an ability to say, nope, I actually am worth it, I actually can move, I actually shall move, is almost pushing it in the face of the abuser that your abuse has failed. Your attempt to control this person has failed to the extent that they are contemplating or struggling or trying or actually leaving you. And that is part of why I think it's a particularly dangerous time. I think the other thing that comes up for me with this is that we're not addressing root causes. And Althea, I really appreciate what you said about economics. the movements and the service delivery systems are saving individual lives every day, and I don't want us to be confused about that. However, all of those service delivery systems and responses are completely influenced by societal oppression in terms of who we believe and who gets served and how they get served and what they get. And you know, there are just stories after stories of women of color in the domestic and sexual violence movement who see the disparate treatment. When I was a rape victim advocate many, many years ago, I saw the disparate treatment in the hospital of women who came in to report rape and sexual assault, and how the white women got treated and how the women of color got treated, right? So this service delivery response is life-saving and is critical, and we have made tremendous gains for women in our society here in the United States and globally. And because we're not looking at root causes, we are not able to understand what it would take to change and end this kind of violence. And then that circles back for me with the whole idea of when someone tries to leave, it's one of the most dangerous times, it is a lethal time, because in fact that act, that incredibly courageous act of self-control and autonomy for the woman, is the absolute denial of the effectiveness of the violence that the perpetrator has been laying on her.
But why does this continue, Mary Lee? I mean, look at a macro system analysis that Althea's generation has to deal with it, the generation under her, baby boomers are still dealing with it.
It's economics. I mean, heterosexual marriage was an institution of property, was an institution of economics, and was an institution, you know, by the means of which men controlled production up until, including children. So it's an economic imperative that there be this, you know, contract. I mean, women were chattel to be brought into a relationship and a dowry paid. I mean, if you look at all of these trappings of heterosexual marriage and that institution, it was economics. It wasn't, you know, a love or a heart match or two souls combining. It was, how do I increase my wealth as a man? And for the woman, how do I get to be in the cast-off shadow of that wealth and care for myself? Because, you know, for men, women were not able to work or could not work and could not raise their children in all of those ways. And I think you still see that dynamic today when you look at the dynamic of the pandemic. Who's, you know, on whose shoulders did both the work and the caring for the children and the schooling of the children and the caring for the household and the caring for the sick and every other task fall to? Were women. And so many families, you know, of course, have failed, but many more would have failed if not for the efforts of the women in those families. And then knowing that, you know, the violence was happening and people couldn't leave. I mean, they legally could not leave because of quarantine. That is a no-win situation. And it's these dynamics, these economic dynamics and the systems of oppression. And I want to say, we cannot disentangle racism, white supremacy from intimate partner violence and the things that we're talking about here. We cannot unlink them. We cannot divorce them from each other. We have to understand how they impact and work upon each other in a very, very intentional and slick way.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race. Our topic, home is where the violence is. Domestic violence in America. I want to move on to question two. And this is has always bothered me about DV. Among the things, why men who are raised by women, single women, grew up watching how domestic violence impacted their lives, they grow up and they end up repeating the same pattern of behavior. Let's start with Professor Johnson.
before I answer it, I kind of want to go back to the last question you asked about why we don't seem to be making headway on this situation. And I feel it's because the conversation is focused on the woman and not the man. You know, so it's like the victim has responsibility for solving this. And we don't address the causal factor, which is the man's behavior. And so I think when we're talking about violence against women, it's a male issue. And it's not just women. I mean, you know, there's violence against children, you know, perpetrated by males. Violence against young boys. You know, there's this institution that protects this violence that we see happening, like at some of the universities, some of the religious organizations. And so we always talk about it from the perspective of the female and not about what is wrong in this culture that we produce men who are violent, you know. And I was watching a video by Jackson Katz, and he was talking about this as well. And he says, just think about how verbally we change the discussion.
The way that we think, literally the way that we use language, conspires to keep our attention off of men. This is about domestic violence in particular, but you can plug in other analogs. This comes from the work of the feminist linguist Julia Penelope. It starts with a very basic English sentence. John beat Mary. That's a good English sentence. John is the subject, beat is the verb, Mary is the object. Good sentence. Now we're going to move to the second sentence, which says the same thing in the passive voice. Mary was beaten by John. And now a whole lot has happened in one sentence. We've gone from John beat Mary to Mary was beaten by John. We've shifted our focus in one sentence from John to Mary. And you can see John is very close to the end of the sentence, well, close to dropping off the map of our psychic plane. The third sentence, John is dropped, and we have Mary was beaten, and now it's all about Mary. We're not even thinking about John, it's totally focused on Mary. Over the past generation, the term we've used synonymous with beaten is battered, so we have Mary was battered. And the final sentence in this sequence, flowing from the others, is Mary is a battered woman. So now Mary's very identity, Mary is a battered woman, is what was done to her by John in the first instance. But we've demonstrated that John has long ago left the conversation. Now, those of us who work in domestic and sexual violence field know that victim blaming is pervasive in this realm, which is to say blaming the person to whom something was done rather than the person who did it. And we say things like, why do these women go out with these men? Why are they attracted to these men? Why do they keep going back? What was she wearing at that party? What a stupid thing to do. Why was she drinking with that group of guys in that hotel room? This is victim blaming. And there are numerous reasons for it, but one of them is that our whole cognitive structure is set up to blame victims. This is all unconscious. Our whole cognitive structure is set up to ask questions about women and women's choices and what they're doing, thinking, and wearing. And I'm not going to shout down people who ask questions about women. Okay, it's a legitimate thing to ask. But let's be clear, asking questions about Mary is not going to get us anywhere in terms of preventing violence. We have to ask a different set of questions. You can see where I'm going with this, right? The questions are not about Mary, they're about John. The questions include things like, why does John beat Mary? Why is domestic violence still a big problem in the United States and all over the world? What's going on? Why do so many men abuse physically, emotionally, and other verbally and other ways the women and girls and the men and boys that they claim to love? What's going on with men?
Althea and then Cecil.
So the question about why do men raised by women, you know, commit domestic violence or engage in intimate partner violence, that resonated with me. I mean, I know plenty of men who really revere their mothers, and this is something that I've definitely read about in the past, that they revere their mothers, but not in their capacity as women, but as someone who provides for them and loves them unconditionally. And it kind of plays into this Madonna horror situation, the complex, that really got me thinking, where because the mother is a non-sexual figure in one's life, there is a special reverence for that. And when you're encountering women elsewhere out in the world and sex and sexuality is introduced, there's a framework of understanding that divides women's humanity into Madonnas and whores. And Madonnas are to be respected and whores are not worth it. And it prevents men in many ways from seeing the complex human person, the humanity of the women in their life. And that the cycle continues because they can never find a woman who is their mother, who will unconditionally love them and serve them in all of the ways that a parent does. Because that's a parent. That's not an adult romantic relationship, if that's what we're discussing here. And I think it's very troubling, right? And but it is something that can be pieced apart if you're interested in doing the work. There was a question posed in some of the reading that I did about this, was, you know, thinking about the people in your life, thinking about the women in your life, thinking about your partners, what is it that you like about them that has nothing to do with the ways in which they serve you? And that isn't to say, you know, someone who's generous or a good listener shouldn't be valued for those things, but understanding what is it about the people in my life, and not to say that you should cut anybody out for any of those things, but to understand somebody complexly, what is it that is inherent about them that I enjoy aside from they're a great cook, or they always listen to my problems, or they pay for a bunch of stuff that I'm really interested in doing, or any number of things like that, I think is an interesting place to start in figuring out what is it that I really value in somebody else that doesn't have to do with the ways that they are serving me.
Althea, that is even deeper than what Professor Johnson said. Cecil and then Mary Lee.
How often do we hear, oh, Johnny, you are the man of the house? You hear that over from a very young age. And I think what we are saying, or what people are saying when they say to little boys, you are the man in the house, is it acknowledging and affirming patriarchy and saying that boys are men and you have a certain role to play. We need to acknowledge how sexism, male dominance, and male privilege is lifted up in the homes. And we need to recognize and stop colluding with this patriarchy. And men have to get out and denounce this patriarchy. And we have to allow our boys to be boys. We have to allow children to be children, and we have to say that patriarchy is wrong. We have to move beyond that, and we have to offer a different model of what it means to be a boy, what it means to be a child. And we have to question and alter gender roles that are forced upon children from early on and change our ways of being human. It's heavy work, it's important work, but until men are able to say, no, I refuse to play this role, then and only then do we begin to see changes in our society, in our families.
The goal is to get men who are not abusive to challenge men who are. And when I say abusive, I don't mean just men who are beating women. We're not just saying that whose friend is abusing his girlfriend needs to stop the guy at the moment of attack. I mean, that's a naive way of creating a social change. It's along a continuum we're trying to get men to interrupt each other. So for example, if you're a guy and you're in a group of guys playing poker, talking, hanging out, no women present, and another guy says something sexist or degrading or harassing about women, instead of laughing along or pretending you didn't hear it, we need men to say, hey, that's not funny. That could be my sister you're talking about, and could you joke about something else? Or could you talk about something else? I don't appreciate that kind of talk. Just like if you're a white person and another white person makes a racist comment, I hope, that white people would interrupt that racist enactment by a fellow white person. Just like with heterosexism, if you're a heterosexual person and you yourself don't enact harassing or abusive behaviors towards people of varying sexual orientations, if you don't say something in the face of other heterosexual people doing that, then in a sense, isn't your silence a form of consent and complicity? Well, the bystander approach is trying to give people tools to interrupt that process and to speak up and to create a peer culture climate where the abusive behavior will be seen as unacceptable, not just because it's illegal, but because it's wrong and unacceptable in the peer culture.
Thank you, Cecil. Mary Lee?
I don't know. You all are on fire tonight. I'm just, my head is like, I'm going to go super simplistic, which is, why do men raised by women kill women? Because they're men and they can. Now, I think my colleagues have been very much more eloquent and descriptive, but the bottom line is, why has it happened? Because they're men and they can. And that is uplifted and maintained in a whole set of very complex and maybe not so complex structures and systems of belief and child rearing and you know, sexism and misogyny and, you know, the man box that, you know, men get put into. In the end, I think it's another manifestation of racism and white supremacy culture. And, you know, I don't go in for hierarchies of oppression. And I think we understand where women fit in that complex flower of oppression and intersectionality. We are at the center of that. And so society makes it possible and reinforces that this can happen. And I think it's we'll talk about this for the next question, but I think we have to think about this almost as an addiction. There is an addiction in our society to violence, and violence of all sorts. Violence against women, violence against children, violence against people of color, violence of all sorts and kinds that we consume in all sorts of media and popular culture and music and, you know, all the many of the things that we were just talking about. And we are addicted to it, and it normalizes for us. And when you have those things in combination with sexism and white supremacy culture and racism, that is a lethal combination. And it is a lethal combination for women, for children, and for women and children of color.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Come on,
let's talk about race, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
And with that, we're going to move on to what men can do to address this issue. We all touched on it. I want to start with Cecil. Cecil, what can men do to end violence against women and children?
Men have to first speak out. We have to no longer accept these heteronormative roles of what society should be like. We have to say that is no longer permissible. And we have to speak out and say to other men, no, that you're not defined by how you have power over women. That is not a definition of manhood. I don't even like that word, but I think that's not a definition of what it means to be human. And so men have to speak up, and, you know, the other panelists, I think Professor mentioned in terms of music, we have to speak up in terms of what things we hold up as normal and permissible. Those people who are lifted up as role models, it is, how often do we see sports figures abuse their partners and get a pass? How often do we see in music lyrics that encourage abusing women? We have to speak up. We have to stop the conversation in the barbershops when we are with one another, and we have to just say no. Some people might think that it's risky, but it's not as risky, it's not as dangerous, because people we love, lives are at stake.
Althea.
Yeah, what I would say about how to bring men into the conversation is that it's important to hold each other accountable, you know? Men tend to listen to men more than they listen to women, and that is an unfortunate fact of the kind of advocacy work that needs to be done right here. And it's important to hold your friends accountable. How are they speaking about women? Domestic violence can look like a lot of different things. It isn't, you know, slapping your girlfriend all the time. That isn't necessarily what we're trying to avoid. Obviously, that's one instance of it. Thinking about how are you speaking about women? I hear a lot of people say, like, oh yeah, my ex was crazy, and declaring a woman to be crazy as opposed to acknowledging the ways in which the relationship fell apart and how they had a part to play in that. And I think it's obviously not enough just to not be participating. Oh, I've never done this particular thing, therefore I'm not a part of the problem. That sort of personal trying to absolve yourself of guilt is not what actually brings an end to all of this. And I think it's really important to understand, for heterosexual men in particular, understand the footing that you have when you come to a romantic or sexual relationship. There's I don't know if this is a real adage, but something that I have said before is, and heard elsewhere, is that in a heterosexual dating situation, on a first date, in any time, a man is most afraid of being laughed at by a woman, and a woman is most afraid of being killed. So there's a different set of risk factors that come into this situation, and it's important to be sensitive to that and to not participate and perpetuate it going forward.
Thank you, Althea. Professor Johnson, and then Mary Lee.
Others have spoken to this very well. I'm with Cecil that men cannot be bystanders. They need to step up, and they need to address these situations. And it's not just the physical violence, as Althea mentioned. It's verbal abuse. You know, it is that level of disrespect that you see people fall silent. I have a quote for you, MLK, who said, "The words that will hurt us are not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends." And I think that's true in this situation, the silence of other men. And we had the greatest example of this with Trump and Billy Bush and the Access Hollywood, where he laughed and went along with this just obnoxious behavior. That is a perfect example for people to look at and say, yeah, you could have stepped up and said, well, no, that's, you know, that's not okay. So I think that's what we need to see more of. As Althea stated, men listen to men. And I think that men need to have more confidence that they can confront. And definitely men with power in leadership roles, they need to speak out. The other thing is that there are certain behaviors of women that by are complicit in this as well. And I was reading in preparation for this show because I was curious, like, what do mothers of serial killers have to say about their sons? And in almost every case, and there were about six or seven examples, they never acknowledge what their sons did. Only one disowned their son and actually reported him to the police. But the rest of them found ways to excuse the behavior. We cannot do that. We cannot afford to do that. And so a mother saying, well, they made fun of him and it was a reaction, you know, and then he went and killed 10 people. What logic is that? But this was some of what you heard back. The mothers could not want to face what their sons have done, but we need to face it. And, you know, we need to say how wrong this is.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia. And I'm a millennial.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things. Talk about things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Mary Lee?
Well, look, here's the account. I agree with everything that's been said. And here's the accountability I want. And I demand from the men in my life and the men in general who care enough about this issue to engage, which is hold your brothers accountable. And if that abuser goes to his grave without ever belittling or violently demeaning or physically harming or sexually abusing another woman and child, then I'll agree that they've been cured and that they have, you know, renounced their violent ways. But until that happens, I expect men to hold other men accountable for their behavior and for stopping the violence, period. I don't think there's any other negotiation to be done related to that. It's pretty simple, actually. I also want to say, you know, on this issue of, you know, the rates of violence in particular communities of color, particularly in the Asian community, that, you know, there's a manifestation of both stereotype of the Asian woman submissive, always saying yes, never saying no, expecting to be battered, which has never matched my experience as an Asian woman, nor the Asian women I know. And a reality that is created by white supremacy culture, where your immigration status may be tied to your partner's status. And if not, he's certainly telling you he's going to turn you into INS, right? Or the language is not your language, and you cannot understand how you would go to help or find help. Or you've tried to find help, and you've been treated in a racist manner in the systems of care that you've been told you can depend upon, the police, the hospitals, the, you know, any of these other things. And so I think this intersection of stereotype and the reality of when there's no choice, you don't have a choice. People think, well, it's a choice to stay. When you don't have real options, and many women of color don't have real options in particular, then it's not a choice. It's not something where you can be an active actor in this. And I have heard from many, many women of color who are activists who say, and I absolutely believe this, violence is not a cultural norm. Where people, our communities have learned the behaviors of violence, It is completely influenced by American culture. And I say American, right? This culture of violence, this culture of boxing boys in, this culture of everything we've been talking about tonight. That's the only culture that has a cultural history of violence. Other cultures do not. And we need to be able to reject. We talked about this last time. Not everything that's cultural is good. So we need to be discerning, and we need to examine what we mean when we say culture and what we're trying to describe and use that term for in a way that lifts the community up or in a way that breaks it down. And the final thing I want to say is, particularly as it relates in the Asian community, the issue of shame. And shame is such a motivating factor. It is the factor that will cause anyone to withstand almost anything because of their shame, that they allowed it to happen to them, that it happened at all, the things that the abuser is telling her. And I think we've got to think about liberation from shame. And I use that word liberation because we talk a lot about a liberation theology. We talk about liberating ourselves from the chains of internalized oppression. I think part of what has to happen here, and if I'm being generous to the men in my life, for both women and men, is a liberation from shame. And if we could start to imagine what that might look like, there might be the seeds of something that might move this along an interpersonal level so that we were at a place where we could act structurally and institutionally.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Come on,
let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. Sometimes listening to the news seems like one trauma dump after another. Therefore, at Let's Talk About Race, we've created a new segment entitled Hope is a Thing with Feathers.
So with that being said, hope is a thing with feathers. So what makes me hopeful, and I know the world is definitely coming to an end, Dan Quayle saved democracy. Now I remember Dan Quayle. He was vice president of the first Bush. And he couldn't spell potato. Yet, according to a new book, he somehow convinced Mike Pence to just go along with the process. Because Pence, who everybody was lauding and saying, oh, he saved democracy, apparently he didn't. Because he still wanted to be Donald Trump's friend. And according to this book, Donald Trump said, if you would do this, we can be friends. If not, then you're not going to be my friend. So it sounds like something a fourth grader would say to another fourth grader. And here these men had democracy in their hands. So that gave me hope that Dan Quayle, former vice president, who couldn't spell potato, saved democracy.
All Vice President Pence has to do is send it back to the states to recertify, and we become president, and you are the happiest people.
That was Donald Trump speaking at the January 6th rally in Washington, D.C. Yeah, that was right before a mob of his supporters carrying signs with his name on them stormed the Capitol.
He was rallying his supporters to pressure Vice President Mike Pence to do something he had absolutely no power to do. Throw out states' electoral college votes. Basically overturn the election that we all participated in. When Congress meets to certify the election results, the vice president's role is ceremonial. It's kind of like the Academy Awards. The vice president doesn't pick the winner. He just opens sealed envelopes of certified electoral votes and says the winner's name. Vice President Pence didn't do what Donald Trump wanted him to do. But we learn from a new book by Bob Woodward and Bob Costa that before that fateful day of January 6th, Pence sought advice from another former Republican vice president, Dan Quayle. Quayle is from the state of Indiana, just like Mike Pence, and he was the vice president under President George H.W. Bush. Pence told Quayle that Trump was pressuring him to intervene so that Biden wouldn't get the 270 electoral votes that he needed, also that he won in the election. And the election would be thrown out by the House of Representatives if Pence were to do this. Quayle saw Trump's effort to pressure Pence as a dark fantasy that could spark a constitutional crisis. He told him, "Mike, you have no flexibility on this. None. Zero." And Pence said, "You don't know the position I'm in." And Quayle replied, "I do know the position you're in. I also know what the law is. And that is why we may have Dan Quayle to thank for saving our democracy."
It's always nice to find a little bright spot. And when you see, you know, a character that may not have been renowned for democratic attributes in the past to reinforce that at a critical time, I think is worth holding on to for whatever it's worth.
Cecil and then Professor Johnson. Dan Quayle saved democracy.
It's good that something good happened with Dan Quayle eventually. What I think was hopeful for me, which came about because of a tragic episode in our country, first Monday in October, which is the beginning of the Supreme Court session. And this Supreme Court will probably have the opportunity to strike down Roe v. Wade. And they probably will do it. But what gives me hope was how in hundreds of communities throughout this nation, people stood up and said, "Not on our watch." So women and girls and those who support the right to choose in very many hamlets and villages and cities throughout the nation stood up. So that gave me hope.
Excellent point. Professor Johnson, what gave you hope this week?
What gave me hope this week was seeing some positive news about coronavirus. I read an article that said that Johnson & Johnson now have a booster shot that's 94% effective for people 18 years old to prevent moderate, severe, or critical COVID infections. That was good news. And for the first time in 2 months, hospitalizations and new cases have dropped.
COVID-19 is on the retreat.
As we look at hospitalizations, we also see week-on-week decreases with a 54% decrease from our peak the week of August 28th.
Cases from this deadly outbreak have plummeted. Now the one question is why the steep drop?
We think that's happening really because of the amount of immunity that's built up in the population.
Immunity, whether from vaccines or natural infection, seems to be the key factor in what may protect us going forward.
And so that's really driving down the number of people who remain in the population that are susceptible.
Before there was a safe and effective vaccine, we had to rely on human behavior. Did people mask? Did they social distance? And were they following control measures put out by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention? Now, as the country is more vaccinated, we can better predict future surges.
Understanding where we are in the current state of the pandemic allows us to look forward to what is on the horizon and to be clear in our efforts as many people as possible to protect them against COVID-19.
But we're not out of the woods yet. Viral outbreaks naturally wax and wane, which means case numbers will increase and decrease over time.
We saw that, you know, all the way back to the 1918 pandemic, where we had about 3 years of waves. And by the end of it, there was enough immunity in the population that it just became a seasonal virus.
When that happens, we say that the virus has become endemic, meaning the virus is always in the population, but also predictable. While there is optimism we could finally be winning the fight against COVID, one obstacle remains in place: the colder winter months. University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation predicts we will see a surge starting in November to kick off our Delta winter. More people will be indoors, and we could experience waning vaccine immunity, leading to more transmission. But this still won't be like what was experienced last winter.
Hopefully, because of, you know, boosters coming in, childhood vaccination starting, we won't see a major impact from Delta because it's already here.
And even with more and more immunity in the country, it's still no excuse to let our guard down. What would you tell family or friends if they said, look, these cases drop so fast, we really don't have much to worry about?
We still have a lot of unknowns. We don't know if another variant's going to come in. You know, people need to be ready to wear their masks again, especially if you're sick, if you have symptoms, stay home from work, stay home from school. And if boosters become available, make sure they're getting them.
So that gave me some hope.
Thank you, Professor Johnson. Mary Lee, what gave you hope this week in the last couple of news cycles?
What gave me hope was really an amazing act of love and courage by members of the Vietnamese community who have started self-organizing to help welcome and resettle refugees from Afghanistan. And when I think about those pictures were horrifying. You know, of people trying to leave. And when I think of the restimulated trauma for many in the Vietnamese community who either did refugee from at the fall of the country, or who are the children of, or the families of people who refugeed from the country, to see those images must have been incredibly re-stimulating and re-traumatizing. And what it led a large number of people to do was to say, I know what that feels like, and I'm going to help. And that, to me, is the highest iteration of our humanity, together and with each other, to recognize something horrible, an experience, a trauma, a challenge, and to say, I know about that, and because I know about it, I'm not going to turn my face from it. I'm actually going to move forward and embrace it and try to help. And I say, right on. I am so proud of my Vietnamese brothers and sisters.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia. And I'm a millennial.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroot News Northwest.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO's End of Year Drive is happening right now. We invite you to become a member today by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. Contribute now and help us meet our $70,000 goal by the end of the year. Join the KBOO family today at kboo.fm/give.
Cross.